Monday, everyone. Glad to be back. I'm Henrik, and redicecreations.com is our website. We are now in August already of this wretched year of 2015, when the planned destruction of the West is looming closer and closer each day. It's absolutely sickening and heartbreaking to see it all coming down the way it is. Invasions, and you have self-loathing, mentally diseased people and brainwashed people everywhere, aiding in this process as best as they can. So why is all of this happening, and how did it get this far? Why can't we do anything about it? Well, then because we would be Nazis, right? Isn't that how it goes? Isn't that what the conservatives and the psychotic left alike keeps telling those who oppose all of this that's happening right now? To have your own interests and to care for yours. Well, that's precisely what Hitler wanted, so, you must be one of them. So it's for this reason, but not only this reason, that World War II deserves to be looked at in closer detail, to revise it and to piece it together again for ourselves, to find out what really happened. So today we're going to talk about the event that is said to have started the entire massacre of World War II, the Gleiwitz Incident. Was it a false flag, as the official historical narrative tells us that it was? I find it curious that in this case, the historians and the quackademics go to crazy conspiracy theories such as false flags to imply guilt on Germany, the Germans, and in the extension, in our times, all of us Europeans, when they virtually never look at that possibility to support the official narrative of other historical events. We have Veronica Clark back on the program today for a follow-up to talk about her latest book, The Gleiwitz Incident, Nazi False Flag or Media Hoax. Veronica Clark specializes in World War II and military history. She has two associate degrees, one of which is in diesel mechanics technology, and she completed 1 year of doctoral studies in organizational psychology. She is the author of many books on the subject of National Socialism and World War II history. And just a note here before we begin, our Skype connection were at times not the best during the first hour. We switched over to phones in the second, and perhaps I should have decided to do that sooner. So that is my bad. So I apologize for the quality at times. Welcome back, Veronica. We are glad to have you back again. It's great speaking with you. Thank you for returning to the program once again.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, we had a very interesting program with you last time. So much, for me, new information that came out. A lot of things that I had personally heard about for years within the, alternative media. And a lot of these items, of course, were challenged. And we finally got a much broader picture with having you on. And you do such excellent work, Veronica, that it's great to have you back. And today, of course, we're going to continue and pick up and talk more about your work. Your latest book is called The Gleiwitz Incident, Nazi False Flag or Media Hoax. And we spent some time on this last time, but not in as much detail as we'll be able to do today, of course, which is good because this is the event that starts the entire war, at least according to the official record, of course. But why don't we just, before we kind of get into the incident and what actually happened, maybe, let me ask you what you can tell us about the background, about the somewhat strenuous relationships between Poland and Germany, especially along the border. I mean, since the late 1800s, Polish territory had gone, and German territory too, for that matter, had gone back and forth quite a bit. I actually looked at a map of German borders from 1600s up to 2005, and I was amazed at how much in that time these borders changed within Europe. And I think most people don't think about that. They think about these nations as very just there on the map for a long time, and then all of a sudden this happens out of nowhere. But that's not quite how it goes, is it, Veronica?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, Wilfried Heinck wrote a very good assessment of the lead up to the German-Polish conflict in Chapter 4, which is entitled Before Gleiwitz. Basically, following the signing of the pact on January 26, 1934, and this is between Germany and Poland, the relationship between Berlin and Warsaw was relatively good. And on October 24th, 1938, Ribbentrop had a long talk with the Polish emissary Lipski, and Ribbentrop imposed that remaining conflicts be resolved. And of course, these were related to Versailles, where Poland was handed parts of Germany for really no good reason at all by the Allied powers at that time. And Germany just lost out. They were basically encircled. They had had a lot of their territory and resources snagged from them, and they felt affronted by it. This was a deep wound in the German psyche, and Poland kind of just flouted this. And this really kind of sets the stage for the animosity between the two countries. Of course, it was Germany that created the state of Poland in World War I. So yes, the border's always changing. Everybody kind of wanting a piece of someone else's territory. For example, Poles snagged a piece of Czechoslovakia during the Munich Agreement situation. So these are all things we have to consider. But getting back to Ribbentrop, he had suggested that Danzig should become part of the Reich. And we need to remember that Danzig were given to Poland, but was administered by the League of Nations, supposedly. But the Poles really had their hands on that, and they made it a contentious piece of territory between the two countries. And then, of course, a road rail link be established between Pomerania and East Prussia. Now, here's what most people aren't aware of, is the generosity of the German side, where Poland was to be granted special economic considerations in Danzig, and her borders were to be guaranteed for 25 years. Lipski promised he would convey this to his boss, which was Colonel Jacek Beck at the time. In January 1939, Beck actually visited Hitler personally at Berchtesgaden. That was on the 5th of January. And Hitler referred to the good relations between the two countries, but he did stress that Danzig and the link had to be settled. Of course, Beck was accommodating in person, but he said that the Danzig issue was not easy to settle. And his excuse was that Polish public opinion was against a return to Germany. So we have to ask ourselves, what was the Polish media telling the Polish population about Danzig? Who was poisoning their opinion against returning that to Germany, which was a traditionally German area? It even has the German name Danzig. So, you know, this is what we have to ask ourselves. What kind of media personnel, et cetera, were behind the poisoning? Were these people Jewish? It's possible. Were they, you know, more or less your kind of hawkish neocon type, you know, Poles that were behind this? I mean, we have to understand that Poland had factions as well. They had their war hawks, they had their peaceniks, etc. And then what was kind of interesting is that following this meeting, the Polish press actually stepped up their German bashing. So it became virulent. So somebody had an agenda against a relationship and a good alliance between Germany and Poland. And of course, we know for a fact that the British were definitely against a relationship there, as were the Russians. They wanted Poland on their side. So Wilf gets into the fact that there was this anti-German context dating back to 1871, and that after Austria-Hungary had been destroyed, Germany was next. It was basically all about the dismemberment of Middle Europe, which was effectively Germanic. So let me just go ahead and finish this section, because this part is so stunning. The Brits sabotaged Berlin-Warsaw relations after all this Josef Beck Hitler stuff went down. And just let me just read this one short section. Marshal Ridge Smigley, who's always, you know, he's the point man for Polish aggression, he had told Romanian officials after Poland's defeat that Polish units were cut off for 2 days after the start of the war because of German aerial strikes. England had promised Poland 1,500 English fighter planes, not one arrived. The Western Allies had ordered the Poles that French forces had broken through the Siegfried Line in two places and were operating deep in German territory. Ridge Smigley excitedly declared that they took this information and promise of help as fact. So the Allies flat out lied, said that Germany was being invaded, you know, fight on, Poland. The remarks by President Moskicki were especially revealing, as he had said that Poland was willing to accept Germany's proposals, but was prevented from doing so by England. And as you know, William Bullitt visited Poland, and he certainly played a part in this. So I'll just stop there on that, the lead up to it.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, I mean, there's a couple of other items here we should just address briefly, too. In the Treaty of Versailles, I think there was an article that was specifically about the minorities within the new Polish territory, that they were to be, you know, treated well, etc. But how were they treated specifically then, the German minorities? But there were others as well, I believe.
Yes, the Poles were not as evil as the Germans have said they were. There were not kind of the extent of atrocities that have been alleged. But there was discrimination. There were murders. There were assassinations. There was economic, as you call it, sanctions being acted against Danzig. So there was bad blood between the two. But the thing is what the German side tends to leave out is that there was German agitation. And this was instigated by the Reich oftentimes. And one of the individuals that, you know, for all I can tell from his account, and this is Hesse, Fritz Hesse, he's being completely honest. He said that when Deutschland über alle played on the radio at midnight prior to the invasion of Poland, the German minorities there took it as the sign to revolt, that the invasion was coming. Now, Hesse doesn't know who was behind that. He kind of tries to throw names out there like it might have been Goebbels, it might have been Ribbentrop. I'm not totally sure who it was behind this. But they revolted, and of course, the Poles suppressed that. That is what led to the expulsion of the Germans that occurred prior to the invasion, that the Germans use as their supposed casus belli or pretext for the invasion. And this would be Polish atrocities against the Germans. And there were two people involved in exaggerating that number. The first one was Ribbentrop, who added a knot to the death figure, which went from about 5,000 to 50,000. And then A.I. Berndt added a knot before he presented his report personally. And this was witnessed in the presence of others, such as Erich Kortz. So A.I. Berndt did not invent this. There are others who corroborate what, you know, Hitler's reaction was. He had the figure at 300,000. Hitler, of course, kind of looks at him at first and he says, you're full. This can't be real. 300,000, come on. And A.I. Berndt says, Hitler, look, this kind of a figure, something serious happened. It may be exaggerated, but this is serious. He said Hitler raged like a bull after that. And he said that he made the call to enact the invasion right then and there in his presence. So we see that the German side did exaggerate these atrocities. There was stuff that went on, but they blew it up into something bigger than it was.
Yeah, later we can address, of course, some of the reasons, if it was more beyond this, why they just wanted their old territories back or whatnot. But let's just kind of dive into the incident then and speak more about, I guess we can begin with the official account first. What does the Wikipedias of this world tell us about the event? As I'm going through your book, of course, Veronica, as always, you realize how, you know, murky certain things are. There's not really a good account. There are contradictions. And, well, I guess it's as any event, really. It's never as clear cut as we think, right?
That's right. I mean, they generally tell you that the Nazis staged an attack on a radio transmitter near Gliwice, the relay station for Breslau, on the German-Polish border on August 31st, 1939, under the command of SS officer Alfred Helmut Naujax. Six ethnic Germans living in Poland are allegedly selected and prepared for the secret operation. And this is take over the station and create the appearance of an assault, complete with a radio message by the alleged Polish insurgents. One dead concentration camp inmate in Polish uniform is supposedly left behind as proof of the attack. And then what most historians conclude is that this little known incident gave the Third Reich a reason for invading Poland and in so doing touching off World War II.
Right.
The first thing I ask is, if it was a little known incident and it was a relay station, it wasn't even the main Breslau station, so this didn't even go abroad, how are they going to use that as their pretext to touch off such an incredibly tendentious war?
Right.
It just doesn't make sense. That would be madness. Hitler really would be a madman if this was true, but it isn't.
Well, since that's what most people believe, then of course this would make sense to them, then, I guess, right?
Exactly. So what I kind of go through is, first of all, Hitler didn't even mention Gleiwitz by name in his speech the next day. And it was mentioned only as a footnote or as one among several incidents in the German white paper, white book. And that's available in English now. And what's more, this synopsis that we usually hear from historians says exactly six ethnic Germans who lived in Poland were the insurgents. The affidavit of Alfred Naujok says that five or six SD men participated. So which was it? You start getting into all kinds of fuzzy details. And why is it that Mr. Naujok didn't even know how many men he had under his command? It is to laugh, ladies and gentlemen. And of course, it could be that Naujok, knowing that he was inventing this story, deliberately planted those kind of idiocies in his affidavit, which he didn't even write. It was typed for him, and he simply had it in front of him, and he signed his name. So what you'll realize after reading my book is that Gleiwitz and the other alleged simulated raids at Hochlinden or Hohenlinden, we're never sure which, and Pitzchen never took place. Secondly, Arthur Nabe, who has to be an anti-Hitler conspirator and allied traitor, his so-called investigation of what happened didn't take place. It is nowhere documented. It is a phantasm. Third, Alfred Naujok's affidavits are worthless as evidence. The reason being, he plea bargained for his life. He had those affidavits pushed in front of him, he signed them, and he was out of there. He escaped, he disappeared, he lived out his life as a rather prominent and successful businessman until the West German government decided that they were going to bring him to trial for the murder of Franz Haniok during the Gleiwitz incident. The only reason the West German government even did this is because the East German government released the film about the Gleiwitz incident. So the West Germans went, wait a minute, this man is guilty of a murder. We're going to try him. Naujok died right before the trial could take place. And as a matter of fact, the trial cleared him. They could not find a single implicating piece of evidence that could tie him to that murder. Again, this is more evidence that nothing took place there. There was no body. Franz Haniok was not killed there.
Wow.
Next. General Lahusen, who everybody always quotes, well, you need to read what Erwin Lahusen said. No, he lied at the IMT. His entire testimony collapses under scrutiny. He was also plea bargaining. Fifth, Dr. Herbert Mailhorn lied to Stern magazine in 1952 about his role in a simulated raid. Herbert Mailhorn was written a story ex post facto. He never, ever had any role whatsoever in it. This is why he allegedly gets sick, tells Heydrich, oh, I can't carry on, I have to be replaced, and gets right back out of the Gleiwitz story. It's so asinine as to be comical. Next, there is no working model of the Gleiwitz radio station. Supposedly, Heydrich had this big plastic model created, and he would show people, like foreign ministers and whatnot, here's how it went down. I'm going to reenact it in front of you in my plastic model. No, it didn't exist. It was invented for the East German communist movie about the Gleiwitz incident. And of course, the communist East Germans had their reasons for implicating the Nazis, didn't they?
Sure.
Next, Hitler did not need any simulated raids before deciding on war with Poland. We can get into that later. He had very legitimate reason for going to war with Poland, but this is something that pretty much no historian really deals with, honestly. They say he was, you know, 100% justified or 100% evil, or that it really was the attacks on the German minorities in Poland. No. all of that collapses under scrutiny. He had already made up his mind to use force on Poland necessary in April. That's when Case White goes on the books. He definitely wanted to negotiate it. Okay, so this doesn't mean that Hitler wasn't attempting peace earnestly. He absolutely wanted Poland on his side in the German sphere, especially to contain the Soviet Union. But because Poland would not cooperate, Hitler said, that's it, I will force it.
Right.
So he's definitely willing to go aggressive. And last but not least, Hitler did not utilize Gleiwitz as his casus belli. Okay, he doesn't even mention it by name in his speech the next day. And Wilhelm Canaris, well-known traitor, invented Hitler's statement, quote, a propaganda reason for starting the war. That comes from the notorious August 22nd speech, where Hitler supposedly is talking about the annihilation and extermination of Poland, and, you know, we're going to be ruthless, 100% pure lies. There are four versions of that speech. The Canaris version is fraudulent.
Wow. So this was a reconstruction after the war, and is it all predicated on Naujoks' affidavit, pretty much? But because some historians have picked up on this, and they have very, very differing accounts on this. They can't even get the victims right. They can't even get their clothing right. It's all over the place. Yet, you know, it's amazing that we have this as the official record, where things are so shoddy and no one seems to know what actually happened.
That's right. It is predicated mostly on Naujoks' affidavit, but here's where it gets weird. Naujoks mentioned an incident at Hohenlinden, another simulated raid. But if you look at what the historians have written, they say it was at Hochlinden. So why is the affidavit different from what historians are saying? And then of course the historians ran with the Hochlinden location. And from there, they started putting all these characters in new stories. So now we have two new raids. And there are historians who claim that it wasn't Gleiwitz that was really even the prominent one. It was Hochlinden. And that was the one that was allegedly bungled by Mailhorn. And so he was dismissed because Heydrich was furious that he had bungled the single most important casus belli mission in history, perhaps. No, Mailhorn never did anything. He never participated. It is 100% fabrication. And again, this is why he's written into the story and right back out. Because there was no bungling. It never happened. There was no raid at Hochlinden, like they say. And then the other one, of course, is Pitschen. And that was allegedly Helwig and his group. Now, the Gleiwitz incident was supposedly concocted by Heydrich after he went to the border area, after he went to Upper Silesia, kind of reconnoitered the area. And then he said, well, why don't we have a raid at Gleiwitz, too? This kind of inspires me. As he's going to go to the border and have this as an afterthought and then include it in this false flag, it is comical, truly comical. So again, Gleiwitz wasn't even the prominent false flag if you go by what the historians say. They say it was Hochlinden. And of course, Naujoks does not name that place. He says Hohenlinden. And then if you look into the incident at Mosty, okay, this was sabotage being committed behind neutral Polish lines prior to the invasion. Every country does this, folks. So this whole idea that, oh, the Nazis violated sovereign territory and prepared for an invasion, that's how it works. That is realpolitik. That is warfare. That is our world.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it, accept it or don't. So they did violate Polish sovereignty. They had these KO and SO groups that were part of not the SD, but Canaris's Abwehr, military intelligence and sabotage. So these were combat and sabotage organizations, respectively. The goal of one Abwehr KO group was to capture the bridge at the Aerschau near Danzig because they knew the Poles would blow it up, which they did. The other two groups were sent to protect vital railway tunnels in the Jablunka Pass between German-occupied Slovakia and Poland. What happens is Hitler calls off the war. he says everything stops because Mussolini wasn't going for it. He couldn't get that guarantee from Mussolini. And so he wanted to just step back. Canaris had to recall those groups and he scrambled. He's like, my guys are in Poland right now, violating their sovereignty. If they get caught, we're in trouble.
Right.
So, of course, he's the one. Him and General Lahusen, in fact, are the ones involved in this. So what you'll find is that the Mosty incident is what really happened. And Gleiwitz is an exact mirror replica of Mosty with different characters. So basically, Canaris becomes Heydrich. Okay, so Canaris is unable to contact Herzner's KO group, just as Heydrich was unable to contact Herbert Mailhorn's group on the very same day of 26 August. This reminds us on poll. I jumped ahead. They had an exchange of fire before Herzner's KO group was contacted, and one person died. A Polish person was killed in this firefight. This reminds us of the one Pole who was reportedly left at the Gleiwitz scene, and that was Franz Haniak. He had supposedly died in the firefight at the radio station. What's kind of interesting is that this Mosty incident could have touched off an international crisis, because we have basically Germans violating Polish sovereignty and making it real clear that an invasion is coming. And yet, all that came of it was an official protest initiated by a high-ranking Polish general that the Germans had violated Polish neutrality. Neither side launched a complaint. This did not become an international crisis. It was resolved between the two very diplomatically, very professionally. And the Germans lied. They said, oh, well, we thought we were in Slovakia still, and my guys just, we accidentally crossed over. We didn't realize we were in your territory. So they fudged it very well. And that's all that came of it. No one ever talked about this.
Why would they swap the locations or the events like that, that they put the emphasis on Gleiwitz then, as opposed to, well, obviously nothing came of Mosty, so they couldn't go ahead with it, but why, I mean, this seems very complicated to do it this way, and also full of holes, so that, it, you know, if you try to reconstruct this afterwards, you can prove that it wasn't, this wasn't good enough to hold water. So why did they do this, do you think?
Well, just it. The Mosty incident, since every country did these kind of things, you can't single out Germany and say, oh, well, they did this, and no, that's not, it doesn't hold water. Because then you've basically, I guess if they went after Mosty, they basically any kind of aggression whatsoever by any country. You do it plain and simple. You can't send special forces into a country prior to an invasion. Vietnam, you can't send the Marines ahead of the army. You can't do it. So, you know, it didn't work. And of course, the Poles didn't make a big deal out of it. They knew what was coming. So what it tells me is that the Poles were just as guilty of aggression and agitation, and that they were also warmongering here. So basically, neither side launched a complaint. As far as Gleiwitz, neither side launched a complaint because nothing happened there. Whereas at Mosty, German commanding officer apologized. Of course, he lied that the border area was unclear and they had crossed into Poland on accident. The other groups were recalled successfully. If those other two groups had been caught, the most important KO groups, it would have been a different story, probably, because then Poland would have been like, this is really serious. But see, those two groups got out in time. So it was only the one group that got caught by the Poles, and they lied successfully that they had accidentally crossed the border. So see, that's a pivotal part in this. A civilian emissary was then sent to Mosty at 10 in the morning on August 26th to negotiate with General Kostron, commander of the Polish 21st Division. The lead commando from the second Mosty KO group, his name was Josef Kulik, was subsequently ordered by General Reichelt to take three Polish policemen from Kadka to Mosty to get in touch with the local military authorities there. Kulik was detained and interrogated by the Polish military. What he said, I'm not sure. I don't know how much he divulged, but I'm sure he knew something was on the horizon. He was then sent to Rukova to bring a German general to the border to negotiate over the fate of those of Herzner's men who were still on the wrong side of the frontier. And again, Herzner's men made it safely to German-occupied Slovakia. The war comes 5 days later. So the thing is those other groups weren't caught. Now, if the Poles had actually caught them having firefights on Polish sovereign territory before the war is coming, they would have had much more reason to complain, and it could have become an international crisis, and Germany would have looked very guilty, but that didn't happen. But again, the Mosty story, it comes out after the fact. We know the facts now. Nobody says a thing about this. It's because every country does this. Yeah. This is nothing unique. It's not uniquely Nazi. It's not evil. This is what happens.
Right.
So.
Well, I find it interesting as well that the official historians all of a sudden kind of goes for a false flag, well, a conspiracy that they dismiss in so many other cases. And what's even more interesting is how fragile it is and how poorly constructed it is, which seems, again, strange to me that why not choose something that holds a little bit more water, because this would be picked apart. But again, I mean, I guess it's fine, because if people don't do the work as you have done it, people go on to believe whatever the historians tell them, right?
Yeah, and the sad thing is the book is not selling well. I mean, I'll be real honest. People apparently don't care.
Wow, that's too bad.
So, I mean, it's really a shame. And the books get into, it's two volumes, about 1,000 pages. It gets into much more than Gleiwitz. There is a tremendous amount of area covered. There's the lead up to the war. There's Polish-German bad blood. There's accounts of the generals, what they said about Gleiwitz, what they didn't say about Gleiwitz. There's so much in it. And then, of course, when you collapse Gleiwitz, you have to make the case for, well, why did Hitler do it?
Right.
What was his real casus belli that he said behind closed doors? And that's what it gets into. But yeah, I think it's just a matter of the historians and officials counting on people not caring and not looking into it. And as we've seen, historians have never cared to clarify any of this. They all just put out a different version of the story and then sell millions of books. These accounts that I've included in here, the ones of like Heinz Henna, Whitehead, have been bestsellers.
Yeah, of course. Well, we have a little bit of hiccups here in our Skype connection. I hope it clears up here soon. But let's kind of talk about some of the things of both what happened here and how what you know about how the war actually started. And also, of course, we need to get into what the reasons was for Hitler to invade Poland. But tell us what you found when it comes to what happened after this event. And you said it was, what, about five days after the event? What happened in this intermediate period then, Veronica?
Okay, well, the best account of the intermediate period is that of Birger Dahlerus. And I was actually able to acquire his memoirs in German and English. The German version has a lot more in it, which I found kind of interesting. The transcripts of Schmidt, he was Hitler's interpreter. So his information is included in Birger Dahlerus's memoirs that are in German. But in the English version, they dropped all that out. They removed all the supplemental material. But what Birger Dahlerus says is he was an independent, I believe he was Swedish, businessman who was a Hermann Göring and owed him one. And Hermann Göring approached him and said, look, I want you to try to somehow involve Sweden and yourself and perhaps some other prominent businessmen that could influence the British, because he had good contacts with British authorities, if we somehow work out some kind of deal with Poland here. Would you be willing to take that up? Birger Dahlerus says, yes, I would. Negotiations begin. So Dahlerus documents like what the British would say, what the Germans would say, what the Poles would say, etc. Now, Hitler did, and it's all documented in that book. He has the entire 16-point proposal as well as the edited versions. Hitler was really freaking out about 16-point proposal. He edited that numerous times at the last second and made it increasingly more conciliatory towards the Poles, because he did not want that to be sabotaged again. And so he really does put forward a wonderful proposal to the Poles. The emissary never showed up. The Poles say that they never got notified that there was anything that happened on the German side. They said, we just figured you rebuffed us and then you're invading. What happened? I suspect that the British did not tell the Poles. The British claim they did. I don't think they did. They need to prove that they did. They were in there meddling and sabotaging the thing. And it was never good enough for the Brits. Everything Hitler did, it was never okay. It was never good enough. It was too aggressive. It was too this, it was too that. And they constantly poisoned Polish opinion against Germany. Well, he's demanding this, and why should he ask for that? So we have to understand the Albionist poison that was constantly infused in these negotiations.
Well, people can think of more recent events, of course, as well. Look at how, you know, the geopolitical situation with Ukraine, America, and Russia, for example. I mean, this is commonplace. You have a third party in there trying to, you know, poison the accounts, trying to, influence people to go in a certain direction. So this is very common. But the one of the questions that kind of remain here is, in your view, was Poland an innocent bystander, kind of caught between two major powers, or is there more to it than that?
Oh no, they had their own ambitions. The Poles had their own kind of mini imperium ambition between all these countries. And what's kind of interesting is they flat out rebuffed the Soviet Union too. And Hitler said, wow, that's something else. I mean, telling Russia where to go. He couldn't believe that the Poles would not become a willing partner with him against the Soviet Union. And he's like, look, you don't like the Soviet Union. You fear them. You're at war with them in the 20s. You defeated them. Why are you resisting a German alliance? This doesn't make sense. We can have Fortress Europa. We can block off that Soviet onslaught that would ever even attempt to come into Europe. You would be our junior constable, basically. We will give you economic privileges. We will protect you. In Poland, all of it, go to hell, Hitler. Wow. It doesn't make sense. It wasn't in the Polish people's interest. So this is why, again, I suspect there was a hawkish element in there. Whether they were Jewish, I don't know. There was a significant Jewish population in Poland. I believe they had more Jews than any other European country. They had some nearly 300,000 delegates at the Zionist Congress from Poland one year.
Right.
It's just stunning how much Judaism and that Zionist poison was in Poland. So, you know, we have to factor that in. There could have also been pro-Soviet elements. I mean, it was being ruled by a military clique. It didn't even have like a legitimate government. It was going from, you know, one clique and one government to the next. Poland was basically a political madhouse at the time.
That's a really important point, and you know, we can emphasize that a bit more. That when I read that, I didn't know that. I had never heard about the situation in Poland at the time, but there was basically a kind of a military junta that was running the country, and they were trying to appease the people at the same time. Or what was the situation like at the time?
That's exactly it. We don't even know necessarily that some of this military junta cared about the people. What's so interesting is that Marshal Piłsudski, Józef Piłsudski, was really the one that worked with Hitler. They had a very good working relationship, and Hitler actually commemorated his death in an official funeral commemoration, if you will, in the Reich. I believe Hitler actually visited his grave too, his casket. Mm-hmm. So he had great respect for Piłsudski. That man can run the country. That's what they need. They need kind of an authoritarian figure. And people that imagine that Poland was democratic and whatnot under Piłsudski, no. It was run almost exactly like Hitler ran the Reich. It was basically the Polish Reich. They discriminated against minorities. They were imperialistic. They grabbed parts of Lithuania and Ukraine, etc. They treated Ukrainians and, you know, other minorities like dirt. They killed a lot of them. So, you know, they persecuted Jews. So this idea that Poland was this wonderful little democratic country that was in line with, you know, the allied countries, the Western powers, is a complete fallacy. They were much more in line with how Hitler and European leaders ran their countries, which has always traditionally been authoritarian or monarchical. So let's understand that first. That collapsed as Piłsudski died. So can you imagine the power vacuum he left behind?
Right.
This was unplanned. Yeah. That's what happened. So it was a power vacuum, much like Vietnam, after we lost our pro-American leader there.
Yeah, exactly. This could have gone, well, as far as Poland is concerned, whether that would have, you know, tipped the scales, we can just speculate about, but it could have gone either way. But something happened, and some of the, from the Allies' point of view, right people got a hold of Poland. Were English, French influences, were they powerful at the time?
Yes, and that's exactly what happened. There were, of course, pro-German, pro-Soviet, etc., but they didn't win out. And that's why Poland went with France and England against both the Soviets and the Germans. It was certainly not in their interest. And France and Britain didn't care. They just wanted to use Poland because it didn't work when they tried to use Czechoslovakia. That was really going to be the quote-unquote cause ally for the Allies. They're like, we'll get some kind of war situation over Czechoslovakia, and then we'll go in and blast this Hitler guy, because he's going to move aggressively. Well, he didn't. Their little effort to create a war there collapsed. So then they resorted to Poland. They said, that's it. We're going to use Poland. Poland will be the trump card. It will be the backdoor into war with Hitler. And their number one goal was to get Russia and Germany at war with one another. And this is plainly spelled out in the book Churchill's Deception by Lewis Kiltzer. It's an excellent book. It has been slammed repeatedly as conspiratard, blah, blah, blah. You know, this guy's a Nazi apologist. Amazon, I would invite readers to get the book and read it for themselves. I think it's as cheap as a penny. I think it's outstanding. And he is not pro-Nazi or pro-Hitler. He gives you an unbiased account and information that I have not seen any other historian or journalist dig up as far as this flight, the importance of that, the betrayal that Stalin felt as far as the British and Americans were concerned, the fact that Churchill kept telling Stalin, I'll send in backup, I'll help you, I'll be there. He never showed up. It's because he wanted to bleed the Russians as much as he possibly could before they swept the victory. So that's an important book.
Well, very, very interesting. Yeah, absolutely shocking. Obviously, people have to understand that there are so many different motives by different countries going on at the same time. But it's like, you know, as usual, you know, Veronica, it's like the Nazi, you know, kind of issue trumps everything else, and everything else just kind of falls into the shadows. And people are like, well, that doesn't matter, or that doesn't even apply, because, you know, there's a new huge bully on the block, and it was all, you know, correct that everyone was going after them. But as we know, you know, the real story is a very, very different aspect. So we should carry on here in the second segment in a little bit and talk more about what the reasons was then for Hitler to invade Poland and go from there, kind of thing. But let's detail some of the other books that you have available as well, Veronica. I want to plug those. I want you to give out your website so people know where to go and they can read more of your work. So please give us all the details.
Okay. I was formerly operating under the business name Vera Icona Publishers. I've now officially changed that. It is now Vilk Publishers, which basically means Power Wolf Publishers. There's a very specific reason I endorse the whole wolf concept. It goes back to Werewolf. Hitler's name was Otto Wolf. It's kind of just a European Germanic thing. And the wolf plays prominent in Eastern Europe as well, Poland. So, and then the second reason I changed the name is because I have one Polish grandparent, which technically puts me at one quarter Polish, and I've been bullied and picked on so much by these German chauvinist revisionists that I've decided to just run with that Polish identity that they have created for me. So it's kind of a snub at them. But I have recently hooked up with another author. He's putting out some really good books. We have Idi Amin and Adolf Hitler, Madman Propaganda, brand new short little book, basically talks about how the media creates these madmen like Saddam Hussein and Ahmadinejad that we have to just go save the world from because they're going to get us. The next one is Jewish Zionist Warmongering, Nazi Islamic Parallels. Talks about the Jewish war agitation in the Western countries leading up to the war with Germany and the war with Iran that's coming. So that's kind of an interesting comparison. I am putting out a Black Nazis 3. I was not going to do this. I've decided it's time to revise that, to update it, to include more pictures, the newest information, etc. It's going to have a lot more translated material in it. It's coming in the next probably week or so. The 2010 and 2012 editions are now out of print officially. So that's, if somebody sees it for $100, that's why. It's somebody selling it independently. It is not any longer in print. Of course, I have the Gleiwitz Incident, Nazi False Flag or Media Hoax. That's a 2-volume set with a supplemental manual. The supplemental manual is basically all of the scans, the pictures, etc., that might be difficult for people that can't read as well, like poor eyesight, etc., or if it's just too small in the 6x9 format, that they can read more easily in the, it's 8x11, 8.5x11 size. I have a new book I put out, is a set of 3. And unfortunately, this one, I'm not sure what it is about it, but it's not selling very well. It's focused really on international relations as far as the Germans and other races of people. Germans that were in the United States, Black opinion of Nazi Germany, Nazi race theory. It's just every single aspect of race relations, race theory, where it started, where it ended up with the Nazis, and it's called Black Wolf, White Reich. There are 3 books. The first one is Black Nazis. The second one is Us in Nazi Germany. And the third one is Nation and Race. So it's really one book, but I had to split it into 3 because it's over 1,300 pages of information. So, and I cover everything in this. It talks about the Zionist war going on against the Poles in Poland. It talks about the Muslims that were recruited. It talks about India and Germany and their alliance. It talks about Bose. It talks about the Arabs, the Iraqi situation that Hitler was trying to support against the British, Nazi race theory, the theories of, for example, Hans F. K. Gunther versus Giuseppe Sergi, who was an Italian race anthropologist. Just all kinds of neat stuff in there. Lawrence Dennis, of course, he was an African-American who passed for white, but was very pro-fascist. I have his account in there. The account of Dr. Julius Lips, who was basically, he tried to be a Nazi. He was formerly SPD. And so he ended up becoming a teacher at Howard University, which we all know is a Black university. He has some really interesting insight. And I just included his account in the Black Wolf, White Reich series because it's a good idea of what the Germans and what the Nazis thought about Black people, especially Blacks in America. So there's just all kinds of stuff in there. Of course, I deal with people that have attacked my Black Nazis thesis. And I guess that's really about all new ones. Of course, I have the Werewolves of the Iron Cross series, too, and there are currently 9 in that series. And if you just type in Werewolves of the Iron Cross, it comes up in Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, you have just so much interesting work that you've put out, and it's like we should have you back just to do a show on some of the other work here. Obviously, we want to continue to speak more about the Gleiwitz incident and in the next segment here, but let's just kind of give out some of the details again. Obviously, you have your Amazon authors page that we will link to, but what is your, have you changed your other main website, or where can people find you online?
It's still veraiconapublishers.com. I went ahead and set that up in February because I was again in a position to do so, but the name of it is Vilkomotza Publishers. So, but the URL is still the same, veraiconapublishers.com. All the books are listed in the right sidebar of the website, and all a person has to do is just click the picture of the book, and it takes you straight to the Amazon page. So, and I'm bringing them all back in Kindle, but I'm abridging the Kindle versions because what I found is people will purchase a Kindle, read it, and then read it.
All right, very good. Check out the website, folks. I mean, a lot of things that you've, I think, never heard about all the history that has been kept from you. It's just incredibly important work to give us a different view from the one-sided one that we've been given for for so many years. So I highly recommend it and dive into the work. But all right, we'll take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us, and we'll return with the Veronica Clark in the second segment. Well, please join us in the second hour as we continue with Veronica Clark to talk about Hitler's reason for invading Poland. There's a very interesting story here that Veronica shares with us. We also discuss his attempts and desire to unify Europe. Was this by force or voluntary? We hear time and time again that Hitler wanted to take over the world and that we would all be speaking German if they would have won the war. What is the real story? We try to get to the real intentions and push the rumors and propaganda to the side. We also talk about some of the National Socialists' excursions on the trail of finding the Indo-Aryan past and some of their discoveries. Into our discussion, we also put in perspective the current attack on the Confederate States in America and the full-on invasion and anti-white zeitgeist in Western European countries right now and in America too. We talk about the Anglo Empire and what is happening to it, the globalist international versus nationalism. And we end talking about Freemasonry and the tie to Judaism. Very interesting, so don't miss it. RedIceMembers.com is the website where you can go to sign up for a subscription and hear the rest of this program and all our previous shows as well. And folks, we have more coming, of course. Eric Hunt, Angelo John Gage, Jess Turner, Eric Kallstrom, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and many more. You can see the full list of upcoming guests on the websites. But we'll take a break right here and we'll talk to you on the other side of that. We'll be right back.